recent years, several scholars of religion have moved away from the examination of discursive textual domains, or the meaning of ritual practices, towards analyzing the material worlds in which these practices and beliefs exist. Brent Plate has been one of the forerunners of this turn, and provides an accessible starting point for novices in Key Terms in Material Religion, published with Bloomsbury in 2015. The collected set of short essays explores new perspectives on a number of familiar themes that have been historically important within the study of religion, such as belief, magic, fetish, words, sacred, or ritual. The volume also reveals the dominant themes in the field of material religion, such as objects, senses, time and space, and new horizons like sound, smell, or taste. Overall, the authors begin from the perspective that material forms shape how we understand the world and solidify identities through physical performance. In our conversation, we discuss the long history of the collection and its beginnings in the Material Religion Journal of Objects, Art, and Belief, the selection of terms, what we privilege when thinking about material aspects of religion, creative ways to use the text in the classroom, material aesthetics, urban space and religion in the city, prayer as a site of materiality, exhibiting religion in museums, and where young scholars might take new research in material religion. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to another episode of New Books in Religion. So without any further ado, here's my conversation with Brent Plate about Key Terms in Material Religion.
Welcome, Brent. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Religion. How are you doing?
Doing great. Sitting here in a snowy Madrid just now, and it's nice to watch the snow come down, even though it's supposed to be springtime here.
Yeah. It's a strange time all across the world. So this book, Key Terms in Material Religion, this, I think, is a really useful resource. I think people that are both working in material religion and those that are interested in it are going to really benefit from it. So thank you for putting it together. It's our tradition here at New Books in Religion to always start with a little biographical note, but we spoke a while ago about one of your books on film, and you kind of gave us a lowdown there. But for people who are maybe just picking up this conversation, can you talk a little bit about how you got interested in perhaps the study of material religion? Knowing your background, I would assume some of the roots are in your very early work, but this is something you've been working on for a long time. So what sparked your interest in this area? In what ways have you done research in material religion?
Yeah, thanks. My journey, academic journey, began with interest in the visual and interested in visual arts and film and video art, especially. Much of my dissertation back at Emory University in the 1990s was on a video artist, and so got to keep up with certain trends in modern and postmodern art history, as well as film and media studies. And this was about a time when people like David Morgan and Sally Promy were sort of articulating religion and visual culture, you know, rather than sort of a move from not just religion and the arts, but visual culture, and thinking about not just the artwork, but the reception of the art and what people did with the arts. And of course, that meant also a move from thinking about the object itself as sort of a piece of fine art to including popular art and even as many of them would say, kitsch art and the low arts. Of course, those distinctions are always problematic, but it really opened up a lot of ways to think about the way religious people actually operate in their lives and how vision is an important construction in religious life in many places around the world and many religious traditions. So I sort of got into religious visual culture and began to do that, sort of edited and wrote sort of long essays to what became a sort of a fairly standard textbook in a lot of ways, Religion, Art, and Visual Culture back 2002. And from there began to, even there actually, I was beginning to talk about aesthetics as the sort of primary place. So vision happens, it's something bodily based. It's not a disembodied experience. It's a very bodily experience. And quickly didn't take too much time to realize that I had to sort of jump to the other senses as well and think about more than just vision. So I began to incorporate you know, ways to think about sound and touch and smell and taste and the many other, you know, possible variations of senses, maybe balance and a sense of direction and a sense of kinesthetic sensibilities and all that might entail. So what that really meant was a whole scale sort of thinking about religion itself in terms of the body and the body, and not just as sort of some theorists began to think about the body some years ago, and it just sort of was an inert mass of things. And I think since then, a lot of us have tried to think through what are the elements of the body, how can we analyze the body and the role of the body? And one of the ways to think about it is through the role of the senses. How do the different senses create our bodies, our perceiving bodies? How do those perceiving bodies change from culture to culture and religious tradition to religious tradition? And ultimately, how do they become central to this thing we call religious experience? So my thinking sort of went, you know, from this kind of visual arts to think broadly about visual culture, to think more broadly about the body. And then that sort of segues into what we, you know, begin to call material religion, which was a term back, you know, 20 years ago, really see a couple instances of it in the 1990s, some terms like the material culture of religion. But then with in conversations with several people, mainly David Morgan, who's now at Duke University, and Crispin Payne, who's a now retired museum consultant. The three of us and some others begin to talk about forming a journal called Material Religion. And within a couple of years, we brought on Birgit Meyer, anthropologist in the Netherlands. So we developed this journal called Material Religion. We first started publishing in 2005, and now we're, you know, I'm just putting in proofs for our 13th year of publishing. Every year it's gotten bigger and more submissions. We're able to expand the page size every year, and more submissions and all that. So it's become kind of a, you know, a nice successful foray into one element of religious studies that I think it's been good for those of us involved, and I think sort of hopefully challenging to many other people thinking about how to do the study of religion in ways that, you know, help complement and supplement the attention, you know, important attention to texts and to reading and to knowing these particular languages, ancient languages and other things. But here's another way to think about it, and in some ways gives a credence to the popular religion, as opposed to those who were literate and would use the texts and create the, you know, the priests overseeing rituals in temple spaces and things like that. These are the popular accounts. That doesn't distinguish material religion. I think it's bigger than just popular, but certainly it takes into account the popular expressions of religion and not just those sort of texts and doctrines handed down by elites through the years. So that's sort of a long-handed way of sort of suggesting this expanding out towards these things, but also a narrowing too, finding a way to articulate a set of interests and give it a name. So the term material religion, I think, is now fairly well used maybe not understood. I don't know about that, but it's understood what it's referring to, I think, across religious studies in ways that it, you know, wasn't 10 or 20 years ago.
Now, the Key Terms project here, it kind of stems from your work with the journal. So could you talk a little bit about how this project emerged as a book, perhaps? And, you know, maybe since your role as editor both at the journal and then of this book, can you talk about maybe the thought process you had at the different stages? You know, this is unique in terms of its development compared to other edited volumes, and I know you've done others. So perhaps what was going on in terms of thinking about this long term, thinking about it more as a book project and what it might do? What happened over the years?
Yeah, it began with we had an editors meeting at Duke University in, I think it was 2010, 2011, somewhere around there. So Birgit, Crispin, David, and I sat around and talking about the, you know, past and future of the journal. We were coming up on our 10-year anniversary and starting to make plans for the 10-year anniversary of that. And thinking about where we've come from, and thought, well, it's, you know, what if we do a special issue that thinks about, you know, where we've come, and more talking. It was really a brainstorming session, one of those great times where you sit around and talk and you come up with an idea, and everybody says, yeah, this is great. And one person contributes and the next person, you know, layers on top of that. And before we knew it, we had the outline of basically key terms in material religion, which we originally ran as a special issue in the journal. So, which was, again, very unusual special issue, but we had, what did we have? I think ninth, what did we have? I can't remember exactly how many of them, 18 or 19 initial entries for the journal. And so we asked, you know, went around and developed categories and then asked specialists in these fields to contribute. So, you know, Tom Tweed, who's, you know, sort of fairly well known for his 2006 book on crossing and dwelling and thinking about the place of space in religious studies. So he was an obvious one to ask to write up a short piece on space. And a number of other people like that, Bob Orsi talking about belief, David Chittister talking about sacred, and Ann Taves talking about the mind-brain connection. So we had some, you know, sort of an immediate list of probably 10 people and 10 entries that would be good, and then sort of searched for others and came up with a special issue that year. And that was really got to be a popular issue, and a lot of people used it in classrooms and the like. And we sort of had always talked, the four of us editors had talked about, you know, maybe doing something beyond that. And for various reasons, that everybody was involved in their own projects. And I started talking to Bloomsbury, and who was publishing the journal at the time, and said, well, what if we take these, turn it into a longer book and make it kind of a textbook? And they said, yeah, that's great. And so basically doubled it in size, included a lot of the entries that we had, you know, wanted to do in the first place, but couldn't because of space. And so got it up to, I think we're up to, it was 37 entries in total. So the plan behind it was, you know, to do a keywords thing, but also make them relatively brief, because I wanted to do, you know, of course I'm sacrificing, it's obvious, sacrificing depth for breadth. Wanted to hit just a lot of fields, wanted it to be a, you know, a primer, a sampler even of sorts, and I'm not really afraid to say that, you know, it's sort of a bad word, sort of a lot of times in academia that you shouldn't just sample things. But I think I think it works for that. And it's not the end all of it. And I would certainly mistrust anything that pretended that it was sort of the definitive work on the area. So this allows people to look at issue like maps or emotion or sign. And, you know, here's a few instructive pages, sort of wet the whistle a little bit, and then, you know, go on and read some more. And there's suggestions in the bibliography for other ways to read about it. And so ideally, you know, it's for people to sort of think about the range of what material religion might include, how to think about it, challenge teachers to teach it in the classroom. It doesn't, you know, I don't think it would work as a textbook just to sort of assign a chapter a day and work through it that way. But I think it works as a, again, as a sampler. It's modular, and I think allows people to sort of dip in here and there and take up a chapter or two for a class. And, you know, and I've heard from many people in many places who have used, you know, several chapters out of it for a class on, you know, everything from religions in the U.S. to visual culture to, you know, religions in Europe as well, as and just sampling a few things here and there. So that's kind of the origins and the work of it. Really began as a group projects with us editors, and then I sort of expanded it, doubled the size, and published it as a standalone book. It just did, of course, it's much cheaper if teachers want to assign it and use it as a textbook, as well as just anybody wanting to pick it up. Much cheaper than buying a whole journal issue. to publish as a book. State of publishing today, which I won't get into, but it makes it more accessible to actually have it as a book rather than have it as journal articles.
Now, just in thinking about your your role as an editor and a team of editors in selection of these terms, many of them are obviously historically important to the study of religion. You have things like belief and ritual and magic. Others, I would assume, are essential to the study of material religion, many which you've already mentioned, right? Space and object and senses. However, some of them perhaps are less dominant in the field in the study of religion or in the study of material religion. So were there terms, people you included in terms of kind of pushing new horizons in the study of material religion, almost more instead of descriptive of what people do, almost a kind of prescriptive nod? Were there entries that you were trying to steer people into new research questions or things like this?
Absolutely, yeah, really. And that's, you know, part of the, you know, on one hand, a negative way to put it, the diffuseness of it is 37 different entries on a variety of things. And, yeah, exactly, as you said, some of them are, you know, very much endemic to the study of religion. It's hard to think about religion without them. Yeah, again, things like prayer, even, you know, in certain ways, space has become kind of a dominant way to think about religion for a number of in a number of ways, from Jonathan Z. Smith's work to Tom Tweed's work, and that of Kim Knott as well in the UK. So there's other ones. Yes, exactly. So things like I really wanted to include race and gender in this, because there really has not been, I think, enough done on that from the perspective of material religion. We've published certainly articles through in the journal over the years, but it really has not been in a key fields, these sort of identity description categories that we use that are, you know, so hugely important in our socio-political life. But so things like race and gender, I really wanted to include those and suggest, you know, that we need more research in this. You know, so much of what's going on in I think feminist studies in religion and studies of race, whether it's you know, African American life in the U.S. or other, is not paying. You know, I wish some of that would pay more attention to the materiality, and I think race and gender are highly constructed materially. It's about vision, and it's about senses, and it's about bodies, that how those, you know, these are socially constructed categories, and those are socially constructed, I think, very much through bodily and sensual ways that we can't just go on and analyze texts to talk about race and really get at it. So it, you know, Roberto Lintz-Sagarina had him, you know, discuss taco trucks sort of as kind of key source to think about, you know, the Virgin of Guadalupe on the side of a taco truck in East Los Angeles, and think about how, you know, race and religion and these visual symbols are sort of tied up with each other. So there's all these identifications going on with these material objects. So I think it's, you know, really important to pay attention to that. I'm, you know, concerned about the state of race and gender and sexuality in religious life in contemporary United States and really around the world. And you know, we need more and better tools to be analyzing what's going on. You know, many of us working in film have been able to think about, you know, how, you know, film depicts certain representations, and it's, you know, had a not a very good record of films have not had a very good record of accounting for people of other ethnicities besides sort of the dominant WASP culture of the United States. And so these kind of critiques are hugely important, not just for the study of religion, but for, you know, sociopolitical life as well. So, yeah, so those things I really wanted to insert and push on. And there's plenty of issues on sexuality that come out in for instance, Anne Pellegrini's entry on movement and other places besides. So those are you know, taking the dominant sort of categories of belief and prayer and things like that that you'd expect in a study of religion, but then also adding these other ones, as well as dividing up the senses, you know, and sort of having specific pieces on, for example, smell and food, and how these material sensual categories also are very strong, even though they're really just beginning. I mean, there's really not a lot of studies on smell in religion as of yet. They're increasingly coming out now, but so my including an entry on smell by James McHugh at works in South Asian materials at USC. He was able to bring out the importance of smell and hopefully open that up for other people studying religion and other traditions and other regions of the world. So some of it's taking the old, pushing on some new things. Some of it, of course, just editor's prerogative to include things that, you know, I think are important. And it's not, you know, hopefully it's not too... I didn't leave it to chance. You know, I mean, this is sort of also as a result of being the editor of this journal for the last 15 years and working with, you know, literally hundreds of people around the world and having, you know, conversations and especially through email and reading hundreds and hundreds of essays over the years on this area of material religion. So getting a, you know, getting a sense of it from that. I didn't do it systematically and write out all the essays and say, here's 25 talking about smell and 10 talking about cities and this, and then added them all up. But it was admittedly subjective sensibility of that.
I think it's great coverage, and there are these terms that one might expect, even if they're not familiar with this kind of subfield in the book. There is these that are kind of pushing new boundaries, and then there's some that are perhaps even unexpected, like city. You just mentioned you have an entry on city, so maybe to kind of zoom in a little on thinking about this entry, what might we think about in terms of urban space in relation to religious communities? What might we consider if we're thinking of city as an analytical category or horizon?
Yeah, it stems, you know, in some ways it's related to space, of course, but space is, you know, and even as Tom Tweed's entry on space suggests, you know, this is kind of a big, huge, diverse and diffuse kind of category, and he breaks it down nicely and gives a nice analytic for it. City is obviously a very specific type of space and includes a whole lot more, you know, including when you take it down to that, you're dealing with architecture as the... As Sophie Watson with Francis Dodsworth and Alina Vecelli, the three of them working on a larger research project that actually they worked on a special issue of Material Religion for us several years ago on East London and the sort of religious landscape of East London. So this kind of comes out of that same project. So the city includes space, but it also includes, of course, architecture. But then it includes planning, urban planning. It includes regulations and rules that are set by city governments and as well as national governments about, you know, how high buildings can be, how wide they can be, how close to roads they can be. You know, all these elements that go into considering how, you know, religious. We often don't think about religious life as needing to pay any attention to zoning laws. And yet, of course, zoning laws hugely influence the way religion is practiced. You know, this has been true for a lot of European cities lately where Muslim immigrants have moved in and they've wanted to build mosques. And then they run up against city ordinances that say, well, yeah, that's fine. You can have a mosque, but you just can't build a minaret, or you can have it, but it can't be too high, you know. Or many bans on mosques have come around because, you know, I mean, it's kind of a two-sided thing. On one hand, the city says, well, we don't want it because you're breaking city ordinances when you're building this, you know, it's too high, it's doing the wrong thing in the wrong place. Of course, on the other side, it's many places you can, it's clear there's sort of an anti-Muslim sentiment behind the city ordinances. So cities offer, you know, kind of this dynamic way to think about all these things together. It's legal regulations, it's architecture, it's urban planning, there's artistic dimensions to it. And then ultimately for me, I'm really the people who, Sophie Watson and company writing this chapter didn't talk about this specifically, but it touches on this sort of long-term project I've been interested in. Guy Debord, the French situationist, who sort of well known for his Society of the Spectacle book in the 60s. Some years before that, he had this term called psychogeography, and he's sort of interested in looking at urban spaces and thinking how spaces impacted the emotions and behaviors of individuals. And they developed these kind of avant-garde practices around that. But you know, avant-garde practices aside, this kind of idea of psychogeography is really interesting, how the geography gives rise to the psychology. And I think we can adapt that. And I think the writers of some of these chapters have gone some way towards that geography gives rise to religious thought and religious experience. So there's a religio-geography that takes place. So religion can't happen, or at least it wouldn't happen in the same way without the geography, without the city spaces, without the zoning laws telling you ways you can build and all of that. So the entry, you know, gives a great sort of brief connection of history of East London and some clashes and ways that Christian and Jewish communities have come together, and then into the later years as Christian Muslims and Jewish congregations have tried to establish spaces in East London, and how these have been sometimes come into clashes with each other, but oftentimes finding sort of value in each other, and certain kind of interreligious, I don't know, it's not really a dialogue, but interreligious connections and meeting points occur. And those are different, right, than if we think about it through the cityscape rather than through, you know, what people got together and sat down and talked together in a room. You know, when did the priest and the rabbi and the imam get down and talk in a room together? Well, that's one interesting way to think about it. The other way is to think about what buildings can you see? Here's a square kilometer of London. You know, what buildings are in there? How do people use those buildings? How does that change the external community, the interaction from one group to the other? So I like the piece on city, and then in some ways that's related also to the entry on maps, which takes us to another part of the world, and comes out of a project worked on in Mumbai on mapping Mumbai and mapping the world's the religious sites and temples in Mumbai. And again, it's similar to the cities in that, you know, made up with regulations, and some people would set up temples just to change the zoning laws in certain places, and roadways had to be altered because of temple building and things like that. So it becomes a very highly politicized structure to have these religious communities within particular parts of cities.
Now, another entry that you haven't kind of touched upon yet that I think might be interesting for listeners and hopefully readers as well is the one on prayer, where there might be certain assumptions about what prayer consists of, what are the avenues we need to think about it through. But this entry, I think, does some interesting stuff because it thinks about prayer as a site of materiality. So what aspects of prayer are materialized, and how does a material religion approach expand our understanding of this seemingly essential character of all religions, prayer?
Yeah, I was excited to have this included in Andy Blanton's work on prayer and the materiality of prayer. His was part of the book that he published pretty much around the same time called Hitting the Prayer Bones, The Materiality of Spirit in the Pentecostal South. And so it was great to be able to include this. Prayer is such a seemingly immaterial thing, right? That I think so many people would say, oh, you know, it's nothing to do with materiality. And yet through Andy's work and through a larger sort of project on the materiality of prayer that was taken up in Europe, and then a lot of it was posted on SSRC, Social Science Research Calendar, Council. They have a website called Reverberations, and on New Directions in the Study of Prayer. And there's a number of people, Andy Blanton, a number of those, as well as James Biello and Hillary Kale and some others contributed pieces to that, Bob Orsi as well. So the idea of sort of thinking about, you know, when we talk about prayer as being kind of immaterial, it's just these thoughts just going directly up to, you know, God or the spirits or the goddesses. And yet when we look around and we look at prayer, we find all kinds of ways that it takes on these material encounters. So there's prayer dolls, as Andy Blanton talks about in the piece, prayer dolls. And from the, you know, 20th century, he gives various diagrams of these dolls that say they're bedtime prayers. And you can find Muslim prayer dolls as well as Christian prayer dolls. And as well as, you know, things like prayer, he doesn't get into it as much here, but prayer cloths, prayer shawls, ways that, you know, certain rhythms and clapping, things like that, and prayer cards, prayer postcards, all these ways that prayer has been materialized, that prayer takes these material forms. So it's a curious thing that we again, I think there's always a somewhat of a disjuncture between what religious people, what we say we do, and how we actually do it, right? So very often we'll deny that there's anything material about what we're doing. And yet, when you sort of look at it, it's filled with materiality. You know, the prayer, you know, even the kind of typical prayer, if you want to show it on television, right, you show a kid praying and they're at their bedside, right, they get down on their knees, they put their hands together, right, there's a very physical shape to it all, and it symbolizes for us that this kid is now going to pray. And, you know, we sort of wait in the television show for something to come out of the kid's mouth. So there's a sense that, you know, prayer is, you know, and some may want to argue in this sort of very strict kind of way and say, well, no, really, it just only has to do with prayer, really only has to be direct communication with God, and it's our innermost thoughts, and there's really nothing. And yet that in reality, that just rarely happens, if at all, right? The real situation is that it's filled with material structures. We put our bodies in various particular ways. We use these apparatuses around us, whether it's dolls or cloths or cards. And we need, and, you know, the thing is, it's, of course, this idea of prayer as being immaterial is bound up, I think, with this individualization of religion, this idea that religion is this kind of personal, one person only kind of thing. Whereas, of course, throughout history, it's been much more broader than that. And things like prayer and, you know, relatedly in Eastern traditions, what we, you know, talk about as meditation practices, they're very difficult to do, and you need other people to do them with them. And you need, we need these accoutrements to perform these practices and to keep ourselves in line with doing these things. So we rely, as Andy talks about, we rely on these things. We rely on the apparatuses of belief, I think is one of the terms he uses. We have an apparatus of belief. I like that phrase. It's a good way to think about these things. And then, of course, finally, he briefly mentions, as others have, that it's part of media. So there's channels on television, you know, devoted to prayer. And you watch your television, you listen to your television, and there's prayer going on the television. You participate in prayer through the media. And that's, you know, the latest extent. And, of course, the Internet then takes that even further. But that kind of thing has been going on for, you know, thousands of years. The radio did it before that, and print did it before that. So it's never, and even orality, even performing, you know, prayer is a performance. It's something spoken out, and it's heard, and it's done in particular kinds of ways and places and with bodies in particular positions. So all of it sort of through and through is a material process, which again, I think if anybody kind of looks at it, they think, oh yeah, well, yeah, I get that. You know, it's so much of the stuff I think is obvious. it's just we've been trained not to kind of think about it in these terms. We've been trained not to believe prayer has a material dimension to it. And then when you sort of point all this out, it's like, oh yeah, well, obviously it's there. Just it all seems kind of obvious, I think, in certain ways. But we've ignored it. We've learned how to ignore it for a very long time.
Now, there's several entries in the volume, things like mask, thing, collection, display, that revolve around kind of the orbit of museums, perhaps. And you have more recently than the Key Terms book published a edited book on religion in museums. So maybe from what's happening in the Key Terms book and then what you're up to in the Religion in Museums book, What should we consider when thinking about exhibiting religion in museums? How does this new book perhaps aim to demonstrate these critical approaches?
Yeah, museums has always been a kind of a key part of our larger material religion project. You know, from the very beginning, Crispin Payne, who's you know, worked in museums and published a couple books himself on. One was Godly Things, and another one was religious objects in museums from a few years ago that he wrote himself. And then he and I and Gretchen Buggeln at Valparaiso University, the three of us co-edited this recent Religion in Museums just out from Bloomsbury Publishing just last month, in fact. And so, yeah, it's always kind of museums have always been an important way to think about material religion. You know, you think about the ways, you know, there's what's that? I can't remember the number offhand, but it's literally hundreds of millions, almost several hundred million museum visits in the United States every year alone. And it's actually, the number is actually higher sort of per visitor to museums than amusement parks and sporting events combined. There's more tickets sold for museums than there are for amusement parks and sporting events combined. So it's you know, but people don't, again, we sort of don't think about that. And yet, you know, these huge elements of our culture. And what we find across archaeology museums and history museums and art museums and others are, you know, the presence of religion. You know, there's sacred objects in there. These objects sometimes were stolen, were taken inappropriately. In many cases, or, you know, legitimately purchased in other ways or donated. And yet there are all these religious objects from various places around the world and through history. So museums play this huge role in shaping the public understanding of religion. And I think that's, you know, important to kind of highlight that this is museums are play that kind of role alongside the institution of, you know, say the Catholic Church or, you know, the North American Mosque Association or various groups like that. There are these institutions that are museums, and they are shaping public discourse about religion. So I think, you know, a lot more conversation needs to go on with that. So with the Key Terms book, we included, so Crispin wrote entry on display, or I'm sorry, he wrote the one on collection. And then we had another one, Ivan Gaskill, who's at Bard Graduate Center now, formerly of Harvard University Art Museums. So Gaskill wrote on collection. And both of them, again, sort of, or I'm sorry, sorry, Gaskill wrote on display and Crispin Payne wrote on collections. So two different kinds of ways of thinking about this, these museums and ways, entries into museums. So with these, there's this, and what Crispin gets at with this piece on collection is this long-term sort of human love of collecting. You know, here's these objects. Let's collect them. Let's hold them. Let's bring them together. Let's put them in one space. You know, and scholars do it. You know, and you know, you can go around to probably been around, you know, your colleagues' offices, and everybody, each office, you know, they've got a little collection of things, you know, they keep around their desk or around their bookshelves. And we're all sort of, it's kind of a human impulse to collect things. And so museums are become these official repositories for certain collections, and they're legitimized in certain ways when they go inside the museum, you know, where it's just some guy's idiosyncratic collection of trinkets when it's outside the museum, but when it's inside the museum, it becomes something more on a, you know, maybe a state or a national kind of level. So what is that, you know, that process of bringing things into museum spaces? And there's obviously a similarity to the sacralization, you know, and what scholars have talked about is the museumification of objects, just like things become sacred when they're taken from one place into another. So are objects. They become, in a sense, sacred when they're taken and put into a museum space. So museums are. So we got at it in the Key Terms collection through a couple of the entries, and then that sort of, you know, in certain ways segued for me into this other field of museums, which I've been interested in for a long time. Actually, I've written about it over a couple of decades now. I've had parts of my work talking about museums. But here I got a chance to sort of work on a whole book project with Crispin and again with Gretchen on religion and museums. And that became, you know, it's become kind of a fun way to think about it. I'll probably keep going with that a fair amount. I've been talking with Peter Manceau, who's now at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. He's the Lilly Curator of American might not get this exactly right, American religious history there. So it's Lilly's just donated $5 million to, you know, think about how religion plays itself out in American history and how a museum can present that and create that, create the research, the collection, any kind of symposia and things like that around it. So Peter Manceau is heading that up there. And so I think there's just these great, interesting new movements in museums and the public understanding of religion, which of course, on the total other side is the Museum of the Bible, soon to open in Washington, D.C. as well, sort of put on by, of course, private money, Walmart, the Green family, and Walmart money, and a decidedly sort of conservatively, theologically conservative perspective on what the Bible is and what it means. And here's some people, you know, you have a lot of money, you can shape public opinion with, and how do you do it? Well, you can make films and people do that. You can make TV shows and people do that. But you can also create a museum and, you know, get millions of people to come in to the museum spaces. And you very actively shape public opinion about what religion is and what it does and the veracity of it through museums. So museums are, you know, on one hand, we can think of them as neutral spaces, but of course they never are that. So pursuing the display, the collection, the ways things are given to people to look at, that becomes a political act, a socio-political act. So again, thinking about material religion through this, I think it offers a, you know, it's a way for scholars to think about it, but it's also, I think, a socio-political movement that offers a bit of criticism to activists and others.
Yeah, and this is the Key Terms book does a wonderful job of kind of laying out at least some of the introductory steps for thinking about this, and hopefully people will check out the Religion and Museums volume as well. I'm always excited about the things you're doing, so that's one I will track down, and Crispin's work too. I'm a fan of. So, what are you working on now? You're always doing lots and lots of things, it seems like. So, what exciting things are you doing now? What publications or other types of activities can we perhaps see the fruits of your labor in the near future?
Well, I'm trying to enjoy my last few months of taking a personal teaching leave, and I've been living in Spain for the past 2 years, and it's first teaching break I've had in 20 years, so it's been really nice to be away. As much as I love teaching, it's just been a nice break, and enjoy Madrid a lot. But I've been working on other stuff. I have two books coming out this year on film, religion and film again. So I've got basically a four Routledge as a sort of big reference set for Routledge. It's a four volume set on film and religion, and it's like 1500 pages worth of already published material that I took and edited and collated and put into categories, and so that'll be out in the next couple months. And then sort of alongside that is the second revised, 12 inch extended remix version of my book, Religion and Film, that I first did in 2009 with Wallflower Press. It came out in Wallflower's Shortcut series, and by shortcuts, they mean short books. And it was a perfect thing for me at the time. But I've, lots changed in my ideas since then. So I worked with Columbia University Press. So I basically added, it's about 60% longer. I've added three whole chapters to it, radically reworked everything that was there before. So it's in many ways a brand new book. We'll keep the same title, Religion and Film, Cinema and the Recreation of the World. So I've been working on that for the past year, and that's basically, I'm supposed to actually this afternoon receive the page proofs for that. So that is on its way and should be out soon. And then one other sort of side project I've been working on is it's kind of totally different for me, but the Erie Canal. 2017 is the bicentennial of the Erie Canal, start of the Erie Canal in upstate New York, and where I live in upstate New York is really in the Erie Canal corridor, and became fascinated with the canal when I moved there several years ago, and begin to realize that this is, it's the birthplace of American religion itself. So things like spiritualism, Mormonism, Adventism, this sort of craze for utopian communities, apocalypticism, William Miller and the Millerites, all this happened in the mid-19th century and all along the banks of the Erie Canal, alongside women's suffrage and anti-slavery abolitionist groups. So Frederick Douglass lives there, Harriet Tubman lives there, Susan B. Anthony and Matilda Joslyn Gage, all of them are living in the Canalway. And it's really, ultimately, it's the Canalway, again, back to this idea of space, the Canalway, the space of the canal generated people, communication between people and newspapers and new technologies, and just all these new things were going on, and it generated new ideas ultimately about religion and what could be done religiously. So experimental groups rose up all over the place. So I became real fascinated with the Erie Canal as a progenitor for religious tradition, and basically kind of beginning to think that, this is really, when we think about American religion, and all that entails, I think the Erie Canal is kind of this basic home place for all of that. It all seems to spring from the ideas and thoughts going down the Erie Canal for about 20, 30 years in the mid 19th century. So I'm writing a series of essays on that. I was going to do a book project, but just decided I'd rather do a series of essays. So I've got a piece coming out in America magazine for that, and I'm just starting to pitch another piece related to that around for some magazines. So I've been playing with magazine essay writing lately. That's been my interest.
Cool. Well, Brent, it sounds interesting as always. So good luck with all that, and we look forward to these other works that are about to come out.
Great. Thanks a lot, Christian.
Yeah.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Brent.
That was my conversation with Brent Plate about Key Terms in Material Religion, published with Bloomsbury in 2015. Thanks again for taking the time to listen to a new episode of New Books in Religion.